Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. I just heard the news this last week of the passing of J. Wahl Jasper. Many knew him as the editor of the Edney Reader for more than 15 years, though he published many articles for the likes of National Geographic, Huffington Post, Mother Jones, The Nation, and many more. I got to know him for The Great Neighborhood book, something he worked on with a mutual acquaintance of ours in New York. We recorded this conversation you're about to hear in Jay's kitchen a couple years back in Minneapolis. This was the first time I had interviewed a journalist, let alone someone who had been doing it for more than 40 years. I was still feeling uneasy in my craft after only having done a couple dozen episodes. And as we finished recording, I was getting my gear together, and Jay said to me, "I've listened to a couple of your interviews, and after doing this one with you, I have to tell you that you really have a nice way of generating conversation." This meant the world to me at the time, and as I prepare for each new guest, I often think of Jay saying this to me. We met a few times for coffee or a drink after this to talk about projects like the book we discuss here at the beginning of this conversation. We shared an interest in communities and their value in our daily life and how we can design health into our environments. His contributions to Minneapolis and the Project for Public Spaces, which develops communities around the world, will be a big part of his legacy for his love of the neighborhood experience. Here is my conversation with J. Wahl Jasper. What are you proposing right now for the book to these guys?
Well, what we want to do is just chronicle. There's a lot happening. The guy I'm working on it with is a real estate professor at George Washington University.
Yeah.
And he's just saying, you know, the market is exploding for walkable communities. You can get a lot more money. And, you know, he's just banging his head about trying to figure out why they aren't building more of it.
Yeah.
And some of it is zoning laws, and just some of it is the real estate industry is very conservative in the sense that they just want to keep doing what they know how to do and not learn something new. But our idea with this book is just to say, you know, show that it's a strong business trend, to show that there's a demand out there, and just simply to get people to, you know, wake up that this is one of the things, you know, and it's good for climate change, it's good for affordable housing, it's good for social equity, it's just good for people's kind of happiness and contentment. And so just kind of draw attention to that. I mean, that's been said before, but there's kind of new evidence, and particularly from kind of the business angle. You know, this isn't just the public health officials and, you know, kind of greens saying this is a good idea, but also people saying, you know, this could be the next, he's saying, and I think the evidence is there that, you know, the American economy got a huge lift from the automobile industry, which is really what sustained the American economy through the 20th century, and warfare.
Right.
And he said this could be the 21st century equivalent of that. Giving people what they want could set off a sort of new era of economic prosperity.
And if you think about, just the more recent example is what's happened in Minneapolis, you know, even in the last like 10 years, even less. I mean, I feel like the last 5 years, there's a real draw to live close to the urban center in a way that's like that had disappeared through the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, and it feels like it's all of a sudden coming back. And you know, this, I feel like just what's going on with, you know, these former small towns in America, and you know what people are sort of saying, you know, with their political voice at this point is like we want a place that feels familiar to us. Mm-hmm. And where we see faces that we recognize every day, even if it's in urban places. I mean, I moved to Brooklyn for that reason. That, you know, in 2000, I was kind of, I don't know, for whatever reason, I went for a visit in 99 and I came back and I said, I think I need to be in a community for a little while.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I did.
It is funny. I mean, it's just, I think, basic to human nature is that people want to be around other people. And we've kind of created a system that makes that really difficult, except in, you know, when you're at the strip mall or whatever.
Right. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Urbana, Illinois.
Oh, yeah.
Which is actually it's a college town, older town, and it's fairly walkable.
Yeah.
I mean, so, and fairly bikeable. In fact, when I was a little kid, already they had bike lanes on the university campus. It's a university town. So I think it just, I grew up with a sense that that was just normal.
Yeah.
People walked places and that people rode bikes places. And so I was always kind of surprised when I'd go other places and go, how come no one's biking? No one's walking. What's wrong with this place?
Yeah. I used to visit my grandfather after my grandmother died when I was seven. They had been living on a farm. Then he moved to this small town of about 2,000 people. And they were roughly like 20 miles from Waterloo, Cedar Falls area. Cedar Falls, I always forget.
Cedar Falls. Cedar Rapids is
right,
like...
Right, exactly. You know.
40 miles down the road.
Because you went to University of
Iowa. Yeah.
But every summer it was like this, you know, I would be announced in the newspaper. You know, Kenny Monahan's son's coming to town, or grandson's coming to town.
Oh, yeah.
I'd walk into the cafe and, hey... Heard you were coming. You know,
and that's not nostalgia. I mean, that is something that's part of our wiring.
Yeah.
You know, I always curse everybody, you know, we've just went through the state fair here in Minnesota, and 2 million people showed up, you know. And yeah, sure, it's fun to eat the corn dogs and to watch the pigs, but the biggest reason people are there is just to be among all the other people without cars.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like, I always feel like, I go a couple times every year, and I feel like for me, it's like, hey, this is like experiencing a European pedestrian zone without having to pay a, you know, overseas airplane ticket.
Yeah. How did you end up in Minneapolis then?
I came here to go to graduate school, and I left for a couple of years, lived in Chicago, lived in Des Moines for a while, and just got a chance to come back and jumped at it.
Okay.
Because, you know, this is a, you know, it's a, it has the urban amenities and kind of more all the time.
What year was that?
I moved here first in 1978.
Okay.
And then moved back in 1984. Yeah, 1984. And, but you know, it has the things that you like about a city and kind of more so. And then it's got this incredible nature that, you know, just available. I was on Saturday down on, you know, what's called Pike Island or Wetatanka to the Dakota Indians, you know. And it's like a completely magical place, and it's right, you know, it's a 25-minute bike ride from my house, and it's, you know, it's in the sort of the epicenter of 3.5 million people, and you just feel like you could imagine the Dakota Indians, you know, paddling up in their canoes.
Yeah, it's true. It's amazing. And that was one of the things that I started to feel sort of deprived of in New York to some extent.
Yeah.
And it was just the ease in which you could get to places like that. If you really, I mean, you could take a subway, you could take trains, and they have the jitney that goes out to the Long Island area.
Yeah.
But everything is a bit of work. Plan 4 or 5 hours to get out of the city.
No.
Or to get into nature, you know.
Well, and, you know, Seattle, Portland, you know, those places have great nature in the city. But, I mean, just to be able to, you know, a person can come home from work and hop on their bike and, you know, in five minutes. I was going to say they didn't ride their bike to work and back, but you know, in 5 or 10 minutes, you can be in somewhere that really feels natural.
Yeah.
You know, less than a 5 minute walk away, there's Lake Harriet here.
Yeah.
So it's amazing. And if you know, and we're becoming, I feel like, you know, we're becoming more like Brooklyn in terms of the, you know, the coffee shops and the bars and the restaurants and the kind of more shops around and things like
that. There's more walkability. I mean, I positioned myself very specifically when we moved back to be close to Linden Hills because it just felt like something a little more. My wife is grew up there for the most part, and before that, Moscow. So just two giant cities. And she was a little nervous about it. I mean, there were parts of her, they did have something similar to what we have where people go to cabins in the summers.
Yeah.
But she would go to Ukraine, and that's where her grandmother
was
from.
The dacha.
So the dacha was like a whole summer, you know, thing usually for them.
Yeah.
So we did that back and forth, you know, from New York and went to my mom's cabin. So that was a very sort of similar thing for her. That felt, but the year-round living and commuting in a place like this was different for a while. Yeah. She's gotten pretty used to it. In fact, now when she goes to New York, she's sort of like the noise pollution of New York is one of those things that I think starts to get to you. But just being on the streets, and my kids went back for the first time in 5 years, and my daughter doesn't really remember much. She was two when we moved here. So I think for her, I you could just see it becoming impressed on her mind while we were there, just what was, you know, what she was sort of soaking in on subways and on city streets
and
just different things and museums that
I mean, I love the energy in New York and you know, I mean, the Twin Cities, I think for a long time didn't know if it wanted to be a city or wanted to be kind of a suburb or most people probably say a small town. And I think we've just kind of made the choice over the last 10 to 15 years that we want to be a city. And in our neighborhood where we're sitting right now, you know, there was opposition to the first coffee shops that came in.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was small opposition and there were a lot more people turning out the meetings that wanted them, but there was a sense that, you know, this was a nice neighborhood because there was nothing going on here.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Even the mom and pop places that were popping up?
Yeah. It was just a kind of a built-in thing that anything, you know, anything that would attract people then was just, you know, and I think the fear isn't that there are going to be people. The fear is there's going to be cars.
Yeah.
Because people couldn't imagine, you know, that people would walk to a coffee shop. Yeah. You know, why would you drive to a coffee shop? Yeah. I mean, that kind of defeats the purpose.
Well, I remember, so you came in 78.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that the sort of the, you know, the age of Mary Tyler Moore period in Minneapolis, where I do think that Minneapolis was at that moment really trying to define itself as a city. You know, stuff was sort of happening around the U of M. Yeah, there was sort of a nightlife happening with like disco and all that stuff. And then somewhere probably around, you know, when you came back again, 84, because I grew up just north of Minneapolis, like a first tier and, you know, mm-hmm. partly second tier suburb, where just right on the border where, you know, you're 12 minutes from downtown, but you could also walk to a cornfield. You know, everything was so close still at that point. And, but in the, right around that time period, that sort of early mid 80s, you could just see the spread start to happen. It was just pushing and pushing and pushing. And I think by the 90s, you know, the downtown area was sort of problematic because it was a ghost town at night and there was a lot of crime for anyone who dared go down there.
The streets kind of cleared out after 5. No, it's really interesting. But I think that, you know, what's so interesting to me is that the thing that people most fear is the solution. You know, you got to go back to Jane Jacobs, and it's people on the street are the single best crime prevention mechanism there is. Because, you know, criminals aren't stupid. They're not going to mug somebody, you know, when there's 8 or 10 people around, all of them with cell phones, that they can call the police, you know. Right. I mean, so, you know, even if they don't intervene, you know, I mean, so it's just, I don't know. It's a little bit the American psyche, which is still, I mean, I think it's fading a lot. But there's still that notion of kind of leave me alone, you know, and the best way to ensure my safety is to be separate from all other people. Yeah. And yet really, you know, there's really safety in numbers in terms of just, you know, the healthcare in rural areas isn't as good. And, you know, if someone broke into your home and you know, taped you up in a chair with masking tape over your mouth, you know, someone wouldn't know for 3 or 4 days.
Right. I mean, and I mean that's sort of an interesting thing to think about right now. Where are we at with the American psyche?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like that I've had this conversation with a few people lately because I feel like we are at a bit of a loss of identity period as far as all this is concerned.
It's a fraught moment. I mean, and I think, boy, I didn't sort of see some of the political events of the last 2 years happening.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's hard to say. You know, as we're talking about this, I'm struck over thinking about the Pew Charitable Trust, which is someone that's been kind of doing research and data diving on you know, the American public for, God, I think 30 or 40 years. And they did a big political survey, and what they found out was that the element that most determined whether someone would be a Republican or a Democrat, a progressive or a conservative, was the population density of the place they lived.
Yeah.
You know, and if you think about it, it makes a certain sense, because if you actually believe people working together can solve problems, then you'd be more inclined to want to have neighbors nearby and maybe have a coffee shop or a tavern where people could gather. And if you really thought that the solution to problems was just simply building walls and separating people and, you know, keeping the bad guys away, then, you know, then of course the exurban or rural life would have more appeal. And I found that just fascinating that's the case. And I'm a little bit of a political junkie, so I, the New York Times about a month ago or a month and a half ago did a precinct by precinct map.
Oh, I saw this.
Of the 2016 presidential election. And it's really interesting because even in these red, red counties, oftentimes the county seat, you know, would be blue.
Hmm.
You know, or at least the inner parts of, you know, the inner precincts of the county seat,
right.
You know. And so places, you know, and so it just, you know, it really confirmed the Pew Charitable Trust notion that just, you know, when people live closer together, they just have a different, kind of a different worldview, but certainly a different political view.
Yeah.
I mean, the worldview probably precedes the political view, but.
Right. And you know, there's a part of, I mean, it's almost hard to imagine. I mean, going to places like the small town in Iowa when I was a kid, there wasn't much for diversity. I think they had there was an Indian doctor in the town. That was kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
And everybody liked him because there was only one.
Yeah.
It's like, it's comfortable for me right now. But, you know, there was this, you know, sort of sense that the world was changing too.
Yeah.
And that was hard for, I think, a lot of the older population. And you know, even in my experience, and I grew up in a somewhat diverse neighborhood here, going to New York was definitely a huge change for me. And yet, once it becomes the norm, and you put yourself back in a situation where you are, you know, just in a you know, a train or a bus or, you know, crowded place full of just white people, it feels a little uncomfortable. It's kind of funny how you can kind of reverse the way that you see things. Because I'm always, I mean, maybe it's just my personality, but there's something for me in a diverse group of people, even diverse ages. Like I just find I'm sort of drawn to people for one reason or another because I think there's something unique about them, and I kind of want to find a way to have a conversation with them.
Absolutely, and it is. Although, you know, it's funny because I was born in Iowa, and my parents tell these really interesting stories. My dad was a coach, so. They lived in a lot of different small towns. And my dad would say, you know, there'd be one small town, you know, that was, you know, where everybody was Polish Catholic. And then the next small town, and then 3/4 of a mile away, there was a small town that was mostly Quakers.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so you think those two towns got along? Not at all. Polish Catholics, you know. Made noise and drank and, you know.
Even where in Iowa, where my grandparents were, it was there were the Polish Catholics and the Irish German Catholics, it seemed, was sort of a mix.
Exactly.
And they had problems with each other. It was just, I don't know if they really had problems, but they certainly had plenty of jokes about each other.
Yeah. And I think really, just to kind of get off the topic a little bit, I mean, I just think that the emergence of Rush Limbaugh and Fox News and things like that, you know, there's always a little bit of fear of the other.
Yeah.
And just completely cranked it up to, you know, to volume 11. And I think that's what we saw, what we've seen in recent, you know, in the election and the whole Trump phenomenon.
Yeah. And it is going to draw in the opposite reaction. It's not quite the same fear-based tactics.
Yeah.
But you certainly have like two ends of a spectrum that are, you know, sort of yelling as loud as they can over the masses.
I mean, there's a natural suspicion that people have for people that are different, but then there's a way that just becomes fed upon and made toxic. And,
right.
You know, I think that's where we're at right now.
Yeah.
And this, you know, this all affects people's health, you know, because when you're a pariah group, you know, when you're kind of looked down upon and cast aside and, you know, attacked, you know, that has a lot to do with your kind of disposition and what you see your sense of possibilities are in the world.
Yeah. And that's what's become most interesting to me as a health practitioner. You know, I started, the reason that I kind of pushed into starting to do this podcast wasn't just me wanting to talk about, you know, healthcare and more health related issues, because I felt like the issues I was seeing in my practice, I just felt like things were starting to shift into a place where this is not necessarily an internal medicine issue or orthopedic issue. I started feeling like there's a lot more going on here. That's like, it's almost kind of like a community-based health issue, you know, and it's mental, emotional stuff going on. And, you know, how do we start addressing or talking about this stuff?
Yeah.
And, you know, I did start the podcast in the fall of 2016. It must have been tied in with Zeitgeist.
Must have been tapped into something. Yeah. Well, I've been doing some work with something called the Wellbeing Trust, which is based in Oakland and in Seattle. And it's a foundation that was created. There was a group of Catholic nuns that, two groups of Catholic nuns that both had hospital systems, and they merged. And so I think one of the nuns got paid out, and they, you know, got an awful lot of money, and they founded this trust to really, you know, get at, you know, what are the deeper psychological and spiritual and physical, you know, illness in our society, and how you create health in all those realms.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because they have a focus on, you know, improving clinical medicine. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you don't pay attention to the social factors and the psychological factors, it doesn't matter how much you improve clinical medicine because there'll just be more and more people. Yeah. And they're really focused on what are called the deaths of despair, which I think have been over, in the last 10 years, 1 million people have died from suicide, from drug abuse, you know, opioids a lot, and alcoholism. You know, and so those deaths, I mean, you know, that's kind of unprecedented in our history. They're all increasing at an incredible level. If current trends continue, it'll be 2 million deaths over the next 10 years.
Yeah.
And so what do you do about that? I mean, obviously, you know, and a lot of the chronic disease is preventable. If people would stop smoking, would have better diets, would get more exercise, but people don't.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can scold them, which has not proven to be very effective. And so you just really need to kind of understand what are the currents that make people so hopeless and that make people, you know, a little self-destructive at times.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the crux of American healthcare right now. I mean, we can cure cancer, but these chronic diseases are still going to be with us. And
the thing is, like, what's behind that chronic disease, or what's behind the smoking and the alcoholism and all those things?
Yeah,
seem to me there's a Brené Brown had something in her recent book about how you could tie just about all of the sort of big chronic diseases to loneliness on some level.
Yeah.
That act actually seemed to be the biggest factor in, you know, that sort of, you know, biggest number of deaths in the health system.
And that's, I'm so glad you brought that up, because Vivek Murthy, you know, who was the Surgeon General under Obama, you know, and is a hero to many people just because of, he was just such a incredibly empathetic guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, the son of Indian immigrants, you know, grew up relatively poor in Miami. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he made a big deal. He did the big, you know, the call to action about walking. But the focus of his work since leaving office has been about the loneliness epidemic in America.
Is that right?
Yeah. And it's really interesting because the data is there. You know, we all know that walking is good for you and healthy eating is good for you and paying attention to vital signs is good to you. But, you know, as much as anything else, social connection is one of the best things you can do for your immune system, one of the best things you can do to stay healthy. And, you know, and it's almost like that should, people should be being, they should be, go to the doctor and be prescribed, walk 20 minutes a day, but also spend at least 2 hours of time with people.
Yeah.
You know, and it's interesting because the assumption is, you know, I think it's more like 6 hours is what's the magic number there.
Is that right?
Yeah, but what's interesting, you kind of presume, oh, that means deep conversation with your friends or, you know, really family time together. But actually, some of the research is showing it's just simply being in a park with other people, being in a coffee shop with other people. It's that kind of proximity, that you know, that comes from dense.
You are a part of a community.
Yes, exactly.
You really have that sense.
Yeah. And you don't. It's been proven beyond the shadow of a doubt, despite Facebook putting in millions of dollars to try to prove that a social media network does not confer the same health benefits. They were really hoping that it would, but it doesn't. You know, and it just, there seems to be, I don't know. You know, you can, you know, humans are animals in a way.
Yeah.
You know, in a good way, as well as a bad way. And so I think you can really learn about a lot about our basic nature by watching kids, little kids.
Yeah.
And little kids just, you know, I live close to this really wonderful park here, and the kids in the park are so happy, and they're running, and they just like to look up at everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think we are all just wired for connecting with people that way.
Yeah.
And that's the way, we talked about the fear of the other.
Yeah.
And the suspicion people that, you know, don't have the same skin tone or don't have the same language or don't have the same customs. Well, how are you going to familiarize? How are people going to get familiar with one another? And it's a two-way street.
Yeah.
Well, people meeting in public spaces, because that takes the, those criminal Mexicans or, stiff, cold white people.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're in a park and your kids are playing together and you see, they're having that for their picnic and we're having this. I mean, that kind of stuff just breaks down those walls.
Yeah.
And plus, it's like, you know, it's like having a fabulous immune boost. It's like vitamin C times 300,000.
Right. And I've read that it's right around the age of 7 that whole worldview starts to shift. You know, before that, a lot of those fear-based preventative things that keep us from sort of, you know, connecting with younger, older, different cultures are just gone. So, you know, that's one of those things that we should probably, you know, pay some attention to in our education system, that if we're going to integrate, that's probably the time period to actually start working on that within our school systems. Because what happens a lot of times instead is it happens in high schools.
Yeah.
And, you know, my son's high school is having some problems right now, partly, you know, and there are some race issues going on, but I think part of it is because they're coming from a different place in high school. It becomes a little bit too difficult for certain kids. And I think even middle schoolers are still a little bit more open, but by high school, it becomes a much more challenging thing.
Yeah, people have kind of dug in. That's the age where you most, you know, belonging to, you know, a gang is, you know, in the broadest sense.
Right, right, yeah.
It's just basic to teenagers, and also they don't want to do anything that's uncool. You know what I mean? So, in a way, teenagers are some of the most conservative people in the world in terms of just wanting to really, you know, just, you know, live by the, you know, the dictates of their particular, you know, their cohort.
Going back into your career a little bit, you started writing right out of the University of Iowa?
Yes, I did. I actually came up here to go to graduate school in Minneapolis, and
What school was it?
Pardon?
What school?
I was
did
in
you
journalism
go to?
Grad school here.
Okay.
You know, and wrote a lot about music in those days.
Oh,
which
yeah?
Seems a little far afield from what I do now, yet I think it's a lot the same. I mean, because music is just, it's a way that people come together. It's expression of people. And I just, what I really love, I mean, I have all sorts of important social missions and goals, but, you know, what's really fun for me as a writer is telling people stories.
Yeah.
And I loved it. You know, musicians have such interesting stories to tell. And, you know, and they sing stories too.
Yeah.
And so I did that, but then wound up, worked for a while in Better Homes and Gardens magazine as a travel editor. Hmm. Worked for a political, kind of a progressive political magazine in Chicago. And I wound up here at a place called Utney Reader.
Yeah, yeah. You were the editor for a while, right?
Quite a while. Yeah, for about 15 years. And Utney Reader was a Reader's Digest from a more progressive point of view.
And because you talked about everything from like politics to culture to wellness to science.
Yes. I love that job because there was really nothing that was out of bounds as a subject matter.
It was great. I mean, it's still around though, isn't it?
Yeah, still around. Still being published. They run quite a few of my articles still.
Oh, cool.
But wellness was a big theme of the magazine. And
it seemed like community was too.
The community was too. And so those are the two, when I left the magazine after a good long run, those were the things I was most interested in just kind of exploring, and then the connections between the two of them. And, you know, it's funny, I've always been, ever since I was a little kid, I've just been a person, a wanderer. I just love to see new places, just to kind of look around. It's kind of my meditation, it's my yoga a little bit, and my mental yoga. And so I always just loved, you know, and it didn't have to be some glamorous place. I mean, just here's your first trip to Omaha, or your first trip to, you know, Mason City, Iowa, or something. Yeah. Just kind of what makes this community tick.
I'm about the same with all that stuff, and it's funny about music too, because I was a musician in most of my 20s, you know, touring and playing around and stuff, but I think it started with me being in the crowd. You know, I had a radio show in college, and we used to get free tickets to go see whatever was happening at First Avenue or Fine Line and some stuff downtown. And I think I got just as much out of just being in the crowd, seeing, like, just being sort of smashed together and seeing who these people were face to face, or sort of having a bird's eye view and just looking at the crowd, as much as I liked watching the music. That part of, you know, music for me has always been huge. I think that's I don't think anything I've done hasn't been a little bit about having this community around it.
Yeah. No, me too. And so just that's when I just started exploring, and I became more serious about that. You know, it's funny. I did this book called The Great Neighborhood Book with Project for Public Spaces.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, writing books always just is way more work than you ever thought it was going to be. And I was on a really short deadline for that book. And I just thought, how in the world am I going to write this book? And then I started just thinking about all the stuff I had learned just kind of, I thought, goofing off. Wandering around the streets of some city kind of going, that's interesting, or wonder why they do it this way. And I realized I'd only been researching the book for 20 years. The writing part I knew I could do really well, but I was thinking, God, we're really shaky on the research here. And in fact, and just all those stories kind of came back to me. So I met the deadline, and the book's still in print, so people seem to like it.
I think I got a piece of that, or, you know, because Kathy, who connected us, shared with me, I think maybe when you came to Brooklyn one time, we tried meeting up for dinner or something, but I started reading some of that. I didn't realize there was an entire book with it, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it was fun. You know, and Kathy Madden of Project for Public Spaces, you know, she's very interesting. She grew up in Minnesota.
Yeah.
And she's just kind of a fearless person. I mean, they had a gig one time, you know, Bryant Square Park, which is right behind the New York Public Library. It was Needle Park, they called it. You know, it's because where everybody went to buy drugs. And so they were supposed to research what they could do to, you know, make it a place where everybody felt comfortable. And so Kathy just barged right in. And it started interviewing the drug dealers why is this a good place to sell drugs? And they go, oh, yeah, it's a great place because you can't see what's on the other side of the hedge and stuff like that. And so, you know.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah. She grew up in a hotel.
Yeah.
So she just always is, you know, I mean, literally, you know, her family's famous for Madden's Resort.
Right,
but,
right.
Know, the family business really before the resort was this hotel in downtown Little Falls.
Yeah.
And so she just grew up with people around all the time. And so that's, you know, she has amazing people skills that way.
Yeah. And I've had some conversations with her husband, Fred, too, about, you know, just the way that you kind of end. And I feel like that you're such a great match for having met them, because he's talked to me a little bit about, like, you know, specific places that they find in these, basically why, and just looking at why do people tend to congregate in this space?
Yeah.
Or, you know, sometimes you're talking about some place where there was like a little, someone had made this like little bench around a tree.
Yeah.
And for some reason it was the most popular place for people to go sit. They would kind of all sit with their backs to each other, right? Because you're sitting with your back to the tree. But it's sort of like you were talking about earlier. There's something about just being next to this person. We don't have to have a conversation, but it's comfortable. Like we're in this space. We're all kind of looking out at what's happening here.
No, I think there's some really rules of, you know, or guidelines on how to make places popular. And it seems like we've just, like a lot of things, just forgotten that.
Yeah.
There's one of the great mentors to Fred Kent and Kathy Madden was a guy by the name of William H. White. And he said, it's really impossible to create, it's really difficult to create a place that people don't want to go. What's really amazing is how often we do it. You know, because the concern isn't about creating a great place for people to gather. The concern is police enforcement, or what can we do, you know, how can we maximize sales, or all these kinds of things. And so, you know, just giving people a great place is usually way down the list of the priorities. And, you know, and a lot of the design world today, too, is about making sort of a sculptural statement with all the elements. And so they're not, you know, they're just, we just have kind of, I think, forgotten that deep human instinct about creating places that, you know, where people want to go. And I think, you know, that's what placemaking is all about.
Right, right.
And placemaking is really tied in with community health and with personal health and things like that. And I think we're kind of rediscovering those things. And we're rediscovering it from, you know, people in the developing world, from people in poor neighborhoods, from, you know, why does a certain vacant lot in some lower income neighborhood, you know, just flourish with people? And why do other ones, you know, and then why does some planned park, you go through it and there's no one there at all?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, just simply because there is some basic principles on creating places people want to go, and people just ignore that.
What did you learn from the Project for Public Spaces, you know, book that you worked on? I mean, as far as placemaking, are there any like really hard rules that people should just be aware of?
Well, I always joke, and you know, it's not funny now because as we speak, Hurricane Florence is bearing down on the East Coast. But yeah. I do a lot of speaking, you know, so I always depending on where I'm at, I go, okay, if we just got news that there was a hurricane or a tornado or an earthquake or a wildfire coming our way, and I could just leave you with two ideas on how to make a great place, they are give people a place to hang out together and give people a place to walk together. I mean, those are that's the core. That's the foundation of making a great place.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, just a lot of things that, you know, places should be able to be flexible. You know, a place like, you know, some of the deadest places in any city are the tennis courts and the baseball fields. Because it's this huge amount of space given over to an activity that people only spend so much time doing.
Yeah.
You know, so if you can, the whole notion of mixed use is popular in kind of the planning profession now. But just all of our spaces should be mixed use. You know, you can use it for something different in the winter than in the summer. Mm-hmm. Use it for something different in the evening than during the day. You know, use it, you know, when the kids get off of school in the afternoon, it does one thing. But when places serve a lot of functions.
Right.
That, you know, and I think so much of suburban development, there's nothing inherently wrong with suburbs or with suburban people. But the problem with suburban development as practiced since, you know, 1950 or so, has just been everything just has one single use. This is where you go shop.
Yeah.
This is where you go play sports. This is where you go to school. This is where you go buy things, which is like a lot like shopping, I guess. You know, this is where you go to work. This is where you live. And when all those things are separate, there's just a lot of emptiness. There's just a lot of separation between people. And you put all those things together, and that's why people love Brooklyn. That's why people love being around the lakes in Minneapolis. That's why people love any great place. That's why people love the State Fair. That's why people love theme parks.
Yeah.
Just because there's all this energy going on and you have choices.
Yeah. There's something about being sort of smashed together in a place. It's funny because I haven't lived in New York for 5 years, but I go back and do work and do trips there, and I go to I stay in the same neighborhood roughly. And because I've, you know, known people, residents in this neighborhood for almost 20 years now, they don't even know that I haven't left. I mean, to them, I'm still a neighborhood guy.
Which is great.
Which is funny, but there are a lot of people that had I not been sort of put in proximity with and gotten to know over such a long period of time, that there's no way that I would have ever become friendly with them in a place where there is so much separation of use.
Yeah. At Project Public Spaces, we used to really say that, you know, that public spaces are the fundamental common ground. You know, everybody's, where's the common ground in America? Well, literal common ground are the places where people cross paths. And that's why gentrification is such a baneful thing in our lives, because that means that, you know, the people that you'll run into in your neighborhood or on your street are all going to be just like you, at least in terms of income. And so it's really where people can come together, where they can meet each other as friends and neighbors and citizens. You know, that's the crux of democracy. I mean, that's what's really needed right now.
I feel like there's a lot of care that gets taken too of each other in those situations. You know, we think that, I don't know, that economically it should be more comfortable if you're, you know, in the same sort of tier of, you know, people. But there is this need to take care of someone as well. I think that it almost doesn't get it's like a muscle that doesn't get worked often enough for people. And so they're uncomfortable with that, but it's so easy when you have the opportunity. And like, you know, the thing with New York is that a lot of people think that New Yorkers are rude and, you know, I mean, they are if you're in Times Square. But if you get outside of there and anything goes on, I've been in so many situations where I've watched someone just like rise up to take care of somebody else.
Yeah.
For no reason. Or if you're clearly like lost or you ask somebody for help, they'll go way out of their way to make sure that, you know, you get to where
you're going. I've had the very same experience. I've spent a lot of time just wandering around New York, and it's, you know, there's a little bit of a gruff, you know, because you're meeting so many people every minute in New York that you put up a little, it's like a little plexiglass.
Yeah.
But the minute, you know, I can't tell you how many, pull out a map sometime in New York.
Yeah.
You know, or pull up the map on your phone even. And three or four people will say, can I help you? Where are you trying to go? You know, it's like you're in their town.
Yeah.
And they have a certain pride in their mastery of it, and they want to help you. I mean, so I find New Yorkers
and they've been there. Like anybody, almost everybody who's there is from somewhere else.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So there's something about like anyone with distress where you're like, I hate to see someone go through this.
No, exactly. Yeah, and it is. No, it's remarkable because I mean, I think, you know, I mean, a little bit. One of the places we're at this particular historical moment is, do you ultimately believe that people are good, that care for each other, or that people are kind of driven by just selfishness, you know? And I think one of the political ideologies, you know, prevailing today is, you know, is fear, is that, you know, everybody's going to screw you, everybody's going to take advantage of you and all that. And if you live your life that way, you probably live a shorter life, you know? And if you really do, you know, and sometimes you're going to get burned in life, and sometimes you're going to, you know, someone's going to take advantage of you, but is that the worst possible thing in the world?
Right.
You know, you're going to enjoy your life a lot more if you just kind of believe the best in people, and mostly you're going to be rewarded for that.
Yeah, I feel like it's
kind of philosophical, I know, but
I feel like it's a theme that I keep kind of bumping into with people when I have these conversations. I think the other part of it is that if we're told that we're not good people in some ways, you know, I feel like there's always something out there sort of trying to say that, you know, this us versus them thing, like you're a bad person. I mean, it's the thing I really have a hard time with the, you know, being people being lumped into these groups of liberals or Trumpers or whatever, is that it's so generalized and there's so many people. I just think the general population is actually are really good people, and if they're sort of, you know, expected to be that way, and if they're sort of, you know, if you say that they're good, they're going to be better than if you say that they're bad.
No, exactly. You probably have run across the work of Blue Zones.
Yeah,
and you know, one of their chief guiding principles is make the healthy choice the easy choice. Hmm. You know, and that's a little bit the same. You know, invest in people.
Yeah.
And believe that they're going to do better, and they will do better.
Yeah. Right.
I keep thinking, you know, we're in Minneapolis, you know, of course, where the bridge, you know, collapsed over the Mississippi River.
Yeah.
And there was a school bus that was sort of teetering, you know, and the guy, the motorist who stopped and shepherded all these kids out of that was an undocumented Latino immigrant.
Yeah.
Yeah, so where does that fit in with the popular conception of these criminals coming up from the south of the border to, you know, to take away everything we have? Yeah. I mean, you know, ridiculous, balderdash. Yeah.
And I wonder how much that is actually popular. Like, I wonder if these aren't just sort of like, you know, political devices that are being thrown around. Or
oh no, I think it's a really calculated campaign to divide us.
Yeah.
And then the people that are in charge can stay in charge.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that all my work about community and about physical activity and about public spaces brought me to the idea of the commons. Mm. And the commons are all those things that we own together. And you kind of think, well, yeah, but that's not much, is it? But if you think about it, the streets are a commons, the parks are a commons,
right.
Schools are a commons. You know, all public government services are commons. Even in a way, things that we don't own are still sort of ours, like our favorite neighborhood coffee shop.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Internet's a commons and, you know, the sky and the air and the environment, there's really a lot of things. We depend much more for our survival and our happiness on things that belong to all of us as opposed to the things that we just happen to own privately.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'd give up my house and my clothing before I'd give up the oxygen in the atmosphere.
Right. And I think if we were, you know, allowed to pay attention to this more in some way that we would come together for these different causes when we realize that like this is our commons.
Yeah. And what's interesting, I did a book about the commons called All That We Share, A Field Guide to the Commons. And I did, you know, quite a lot of research on, you know, looking historically at the commons. And one of the most interesting sort of research areas that I didn't know that much about, you know, we've been told there's the selfish gene.
Right, yeah.
And that evolution is based upon this, you know, the survival of the fittest and all things like that. But there's just as much evidence, probably more evidence, that actually, you know, human evolution and human survival has been based upon cooperation. Yeah, there certainly are, you know, there is a certain selfishness that's a part of our makeup, but, you know, but we tend to be a lot more cooperative than we are selfish.
Maybe there's a gene that's like the fear of loneliness gene that's even more powerful than the selfish gene.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just, you know, the new realms of science, you know, there's some fascinating things in there. And sometimes it's just, you know, a certain idea that happens to sort of fit the prevailing worldview gets all this attention. But there's a lot of things that just fly completely in the face of that.
Yeah, I get very sort of taken in by the sort of Malcolm Gladwell type writings, you know, sometimes where it's like, it's so convincing, you know, because I'm a bit of a science junkie, like I will read these things, to, you know, the next new thing that comes out, and I can be very sort of convinced for some period of time. When I feel like just being in the space of the writing and processing it, then I start to see it everywhere, but I almost always find, you know, the counter to the example. And it seems to be like a big thing. There was this, you know, the one that he had not too long ago about, he was talking about school. I had a child at the time, and he was talking about school age children being pushed forward into school, and that was that's going to cause problems for this child because they're going to be smaller, and their intelligence at, you know, even 6 months back is so different that it can start to affect their, you know, their ability to have, you know, sort of confidence in what they're doing. But, and I have a child who was going through exactly this. He's at a late August birthday.
Trying
to figure out whether to push him into the next school year or hold him back, and very smart in certain ways and behind in other ways. And, you know, we ended up, you know, deciding that because he was tall and because he was so advanced in some things, that to hold him back seemed like it would be worse for him. And yet this book, I was totally sold that we should have waited another year.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And yet I think a lot of what he's gotten confidence-wise has come from overcoming some of those obstacles. So that wasn't part of that wasn't anywhere, you know, touched in the book. So
yeah, I think one thing in that book is, you know, it's like there's like 4 months that are preponderance of National Hockey League players were born in. Mm-hmm. And there's just sort of something about whatever, you know, for some reason, you know, they were the biggest kids on the ice or something. And it's just amazing. Yeah. Well, there's a whole notion, you know, that's often treated like gospel truth in our society, the notion of homo economus, which is that, you know, that, and most economists believe people do this, you know, that they basically make all their decisions just kind of based upon self-interest, you know, and the homo economist argument is that by all means you should put your child into school as soon as possible because they'll have more years earning in the market. And yet, you know, that sort of seems ridiculous, but you know, that kind of reasoning is affecting a lot of things in our culture. It's just, what maximizes profit, what maximizes wealth, and not paying any attention to the wreckage that's left behind by that.
Yeah.
And, you know, but the whole notion that as a species, we're driven by just simply economic betterment, you know, it's just a lie.
Yeah.
Yeah. As a journalist, I mean, one of the things that's always been one of my kind of nose for news is I try to look at things that I see in my life, around me, in my neighborhood, my community, my group of friends, my family, that don't tend to get written about or talked about in the broader media.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, that's really interesting to me, you know, that, you know, such things don't really exist if you just believe what you, you know, see on Netflix and what you see, you know, on your favorite website sources and things like that. And I kind of go, because I think there's just, you know, the media is not an accurate assessment of the world around us.
Right.
And particularly the larger the media, the less that's true. And there's an awful lot they miss because of their own sort of perceptions and biases. And so I'm always...
And self-interest. And,
yeah.
You know, I think we long to be entertained on some level,
yeah.
and they know that they can make money off of that. And whether it's a news or a book or a show or whatever, they know they're tapping that to some extent, and you know, trying to hit. There's this probably cross between or whatever where the paths cross between what's happening culturally, and that plays into like all the. The fears and all the excitements or whatever that are going on. So they find those moments to really capitalize on some of that stuff. And yet at the same time, there's plenty that can come out of that. That's very thought provoking, but it's not necessarily real. But
exactly.
You know, I feel like you like to kind of get down at the street level and with everything I've read that you've done.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things you asked me a couple of minutes ago is, you know, what I learned doing the book, the Great Neighborhood book with Project for Public Spaces. And this is one of the big Project for Public Spaces lessons, but this was just driven home over and over in the book, is that the community is the expert. You know, in your particular, because we live in kind of an expert culture now. And, so the urban planner is going to tell you what's best for your neighborhood, or the economic planner is going to tell you why the Walmart is going to be so much better for you, even though your all year local stores are going to close their doors. But really, the world's leading authority on a particular neighborhood are the people who live there.
Yeah.
Not someone who has studied neighborhoods all over the world and da 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 da.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, a little bit of humility.
Yeah, it's true. It's in my field. This is one of the things that actually led to the podcast a little bit. Was I was working with a doctor who was really trying to solve some of the more relationship related communications issues around healthcare. And one of the things that I think we don't do very well in healthcare is ask people more questions about themselves. They're actually the experts about themselves.
Yeah.
And you know, it's the doctors. If they get enough information, are experts. But if they're not asking for the information, they're not getting the right. Yeah. They're not getting the right details. So where do you start then?
And there's kind of a movement, you probably know about this, but to expand what are seen as the vital signs. Mm. You know, because you know you're asked about your smoking. You know, you're sometimes shamed about your smoking, or you're asked about, you know, here's your blood pressure and things like that. But no one's asking you how much exercise do you get a day. Or, you know, how much time do you spend with friends?
Yeah. What are your relationships?
Because, you know,
like?
Those questions, you remember those questions because you're being asked by a medical authority.
Yeah.
And so if they asked you, you know, how much do you volunteer in the community? That would make a difference to you. I mean, some of it is just taking those moments. And the Well-Being Trust that I've been doing some work with, they're doing...
Yeah. What? Tell me about that.
Well, they're, you know, trying to really sort of bring a, you know, for, I mean, this is big thinking, but kind of a new paradigm to health. And they talk about there's the vital signs, but also the vital conditions, you know, that these things have to be present for people to be healthy. And that's, you know, shelter, a sense of safety, opportunities for education and lifelong learning, opportunities to be able to be more physically active, you know. Opportunities to eat good, healthy food. Those things, you know, are just as important to our health. And the University of Wisconsin Population Institute, which is kind of one of the leading, you know, sort of sources on health demographics and data, last summer just came out with a, I thought, rather striking conclusion. They said that 20% of people's health is attributable to clinical medicine. And 80% of it depends upon, you know, personal habits, the kind of community they live in, you know, not even access to healthcare, but just, you know, the whole context of life. And that, you know, that's a pretty, you know, because, you know, let's face it. I mean, healthcare is closing in on 20% of our GDP.
Yeah.
And growing. You know, that is not the sign of a healthy culture.
No.
And, you know, and I think we need, and the solution just isn't going to be what happens in the doctor's office. The solution has to be what happens everywhere else.
Yeah.
You know, and even if you're a fiscal conservative and you hate government spending, well, there's a place to start. How do you make people more healthy?
Yeah. I mean, I think the problem, you know, there is, I do think some that whatever, how many trillion, $4 or $5 trillion or whatever that 20% GDP is,
it's
supporting the economy on some level. And so, you know, people really like when that number gets kind of pushed.
Yeah.
But it's not sustainable. That's the problem. You know, what's happening with people, exactly what you're saying. Yeah. It's going to get to a point where, and we're behavioral creatures of habit. So the way that, you know, the way that we sort of pattern our lives and the way that patterns in culturally, that's that other 80% for the most part.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the real challenge here is how do you do behavior change? You know, you're trying to modify and even little shifts are going to make a huge difference in people's health. That's the one thing that I've, you know, sort of worked on my whole career is like just those little things. It's sort of, what was the thing that you said earlier with the Blue Zones, you know,
oh yeah, make the healthy choice the easy choice.
The easy choice,
you the know? Obvious
so
choice,
I, the,
really.
Yeah, I just find whatever that first easy choice is. Like, how do you get started down a new path? It's usually that one easy choice, the one thing that you can do. Like, it's why I love your writing about walking because it's the one easy choice. I almost always start there with people.
Yeah,
and it's one of those things that can be done anywhere. And, you know, adding other pieces into that, like cycling or, you know, something else that also is, it's, and there's a cost effective aspect of all this stuff too.
Oh, there's just so many little things that can add up, you know. Think about it. If you go to a shopping mall, you actually probably wind up walking quite a bit from the distant parking lot to the store that's on the farther side. So if you don't shop at shopping malls, why not park 3 blocks? from your destination. I mean, you'll get some exercise that way. You know, it's really amazing. It all adds up. And, you know, and a lot of the things, you know, historically, people didn't work out.
Right.
They gardened and they did housework and they walked places. And it wasn't like, oh, I'm exercising now. I'm being so virtuous. It was more just simply, that was just the natural part of their life.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that I think that's true with all kinds of things in terms of just, you know, sugar was something that was sort of a scarce commodity. You know, there wasn't a lot of honey created and sugar cane came from far away and things like that. And so, you know, so it wasn't just, we didn't just constantly get fed sugar, 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 sugar. I mean, sugar's in its own way is a wonderful thing.
Right.
But it's just simply when it becomes kind of de facto, default, really. Just like, okay, yeah, and there's, you know, sweetener added to this and sweetener added to that. And just, you know, there's a, and, you know, so, and it really is, we need big political changes and economic changes in the world, but also just simply, fundamentally, you know, how people, you know, the small decisions in their life all add up.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's what I love to kind of draw attention on what people can do, which isn't to say that we don't also need to make huge differences. And, you know, it's not an either or.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the, you have to stop the bleeding and at the same time change people's consciousness. So both are important.
You need to keep your awareness and attention to what's going on, but you shouldn't do that at the sacrifice of your own health and actually, you know, making those small changes for yourself right now. I think this is one of the things that I've gotten from a lot of health professionals is they get very frustrated in their jobs that people just seem disengaged from the care of their own bodies.
You know?
And their minds and, you know, their emotional, you know, state and everything too. It's like,
and that gets to be kind of philosophical. I mean, modernity's metaphor is that everything is like a machine. you know, or maybe now we say it's about, you know, it's like an internet or something like that, you know. Yeah. But it's so if you view that way, then, you know, then it's not food, it's fuel, you know. And even sometimes our health consciousness takes that attitude too.
Right.
If I just run 3 miles a day or something like that, and it's just that, just to, you know, we're missing so much, and we're kind of just narrowing things down.
Everything becomes mechanistic.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and if your metaphor is the world is a living thing, then you make kind of different choices.
Yeah, and that is the one thing that I find we miss out on in certain. I mean, Minneapolis is I really think is a great blend where you have nature at your disposal. You can be reminded that you live on dirt.
Yeah, yeah.
And
exactly.
With trees around you and with water. Yeah. But, you know, some places like New York, it's just a sidewalk on top of an island. You don't know. You don't even know where you are in the universe.
Yeah. I mean, I love big cities, but I would really miss the crickets.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's something vital about that for us being creatures of flesh, you know, and what we actually need from the planet, and, you know, to really be tapped into that on a regular basis. Otherwise, I think that's also part of the reason that we treat each other this way, that maybe we treat each other sort of mechanically
What can this person do for me?
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because I really do believe that science is on our side, too. And I don't mean just the science about proving climate change, but there was a fascinating article in the... It was a while back in the New York Times Magazine, just saying that, you know, really the human body should be thought of less as an organism and more as an ecosystem.
Right.
Because, you know, we have all the flora in our gut, mm-hmm. you know, that without it, you know, we would die. You know, our immune system, you know, is not like a boiler. Our immune system is like a living thing.
Yeah.
You know, and all this sort of stuff. I mean, it's there.
And very complex. And we should think about our communities the same way.
Exactly, yeah.
That, you know, we even though we may not see, you know, our neighbor across the street all the time, there are certain things, there's a support there, whether we're actually interacting or not.
No, the ecosystem model, I think, really is kind of the basic building block of the universe, you know, not the molecular structure, but it's the whole ecosystem.
Yeah.
You know, and the thrust of modernity has often been to kind of look at things in ever smaller, you know, isolate ever smaller parts of things. But, you know, the connectedness of things is there's remarkable scientific research about that. You know, the book came out about a year ago, but there was this German forester wrote a book about trees. And he did not do any new basic research. This is all stuff that people knew, but that most people didn't know. You know, that experts knew. But, you know, trees communicate with one another. There are stumps that have been around for 500 years because the trees are all connected. I'm not making this up. Mm-hmm. The trees are all connected through these fungal networks. Mushroom networks, mm-hmm. fungi networks, I mean. And so they will send kind of sugary substances through the fungal networks to keep certain stumps from decaying, whereas other stumps will decay in a short amount of time. I mean, this was no breakthrough. This just simply, if there's a certain predator that is attacking one particular tree, then they will send through the fungal network. They call it the wood wide web. And other trees then may start, you know, secrete some thing that, you know, that would drive these predators away or something. I mean, and it's amazing.
I saw a show one time. They were talking about that in a forest of trees, there are actually like trees that are like mother trees for the area.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, you know, we don't realize going in and you know, doing foresting work or when, you know, lumber companies are going in, that if they get the wrong tree, they may make it really hard for trees to grow there ever again.
Yeah, no, I mean...
Because of the root system that has been built by the mother tree.
Yeah, there's so much that we can, you know, that we're learning that just needs to be disseminated. So that's what makes me an optimist. I mean, you know, this thing that I have to believe that this information is going to get in the right hands. And power to the people, information to the people.
Good. Well, thank you. I we could go on for hours talking about this. I'd love to, keep this conversation going, and maybe we can, as you get through this book,
I just talked with my co-author today. One of the interesting things, the guy that I'm working on the book with, and we don't have we're still kind of in the outline stage, is a guy named Christopher Leinberger. And he's a former real estate developer who now teaches in the business school at George Washington University. And he has really been studying and covering the whole notion of walkable communities for, probably 15 years now, from a real estate perspective, but also from why they're important just to make lives better for people. And he says there's such a demand for walkable communities right now that he imagines over the next 15 or 20 years, nearly every social consequences, but nearly every kind of old historic walkable pre-World War II neighborhood will probably become revitalized. Huh. And that's right now where an awful lot of, lower income people live.
Yeah.
And hopefully it'll be revitalized in a way that they're not driven out of their neighborhoods, but just simply there's such a huge demand for it. And, so the job now is how to take the places that were, created after 1950 and how to make those places, kind of retrofit them to make them walkable. And this has huge consequences for, as we've discussed so thoroughly here, people's happiness, people's sense of community, climate change, crime,
livelihood,
the strength, and the whole bit. So anyway, it feels like a really perilous time, and sometimes I just even dread looking at my phone in the morning just to see what happened the night before. But at the same time, there's just opportunities there, and it's just I just have to believe that. Like the trees in the forest will prevail.
I feel the same way. Well, I appreciate your optimism, and I try to have the same, and I try to bring as much of this out there as possible too. And I think there are, people like you who are out there, sort of pushing these ideas out there so that it becomes part of the public consciousness too. So
yeah, it's been really fun talking.
You too. Blast, so. All right, thanks so much.
Oh sure.
I too hope the trees and forests will prevail, Jay. Thank you for all of your contributions. Have a peaceful rest, my friend.